Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Julia LaRose Show. We have a returning guest. We are joined today by Jeff Snyder. He is the host of the Eurodollar University podcast, and he's also one of the foremost experts on the monetary system, especially the Eurodollar money system. In this episode, we do an exploration of the economic picture, which has a lot of ambiguity. There are a lot of divergent opinions and divergent data. Jeff explains why we are seeing this slow and painful grind downward in the business cycle. And ultimately, we're moving in the direction of a recession. It's just much more prolonged to get there, but that's what the data is starting to signal. We also discuss some of the lurking risks in the shadow, including the Chinese real estate bubble and the commercial real estate situation here in the US. I really enjoyed this conversation with Jeff. I always get an in-depth look into how the Federal Reserve and the monetary system really works, and I hope you all enjoy this one as much as I did. Jeff Snyder, host of the Eurodollar University podcast, and also one of the foremost experts on the monetary system, especially the Eurodollar money system. It is so great to welcome you back to the show, Jeff. Great to see you again. Thank you so much for taking the time to come back.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Julia. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I loved having you on for episode 67, which was such a long time ago now. And we did that deep dive into the Eurodollar money system, which was so fascinating. And you were such a hit with the audience. And Jeff, I want to start where I always start with my guests. And that is to get their, you know, big picture macro view. Where are we today when it comes to the macro picture? And one of the things about this show is take all the time you need to set the stage when it comes to the macro view.
Oh, you may regret saying that.
No, I won't. I'm telling you, the record is 22 minutes, just so you know.
Oh, I could do a half hour monologue, sure. No, I think where we are is general confusion. People have no sense of where we're going, and for good reason, because it seems like every time we seem to get a little bit of clarity on either consumer prices or recession or soft landing, something comes along and it's like, okay, now we're right back into the ambiguity again. I think that's what's characterized the not just the U.S. economy, but the global situation over the last year, even longer, is just general ambiguity. Because you see risks everywhere, whether it be commercial real estate in the United States or China's massive real estate bubble that we know that's going to be a problem too. Yet you look at the U.S. statistics in particular, GDP seems to be doing really well. The payroll reports come in better than expected. But even then in the U.S. economy, yes, the headline payroll number was good, but you look under the surface and it was horrible. It's like, wait a minute. We've got a boom in the headline payroll and you've got a recession in hours worked and these household survey. It's a complete and utter mess. And it's understandable why people are confused. And then the Federal Reserve comes in and they confuse people even more. Because what did they do in December? Jay Powell starts out and says, no, we're not talking about rate cuts. There's no reason to talk about rate cuts. 2 weeks later at his press conference, he said, yep, we're talking about rate cuts. And then now what is the Fed? Oh, no, maybe we're not talking about rate cuts. They have no clue either. So people are just lost in the sea of what is going on here. And so the general sense that I have of the economy is that we're painfully slowly progressing in what is still a business cycle. And it is the downswing of the business cycle. And even if you lose patience with it, it's still happening and you still see it happening in quite a bit of data, quite a bit of places around the world. We were just reminded of that just this week. UK falls into recession. Japan falls into recession. Germany's a mess. So more and more, the cycle continues to progress at a very slow pace. And as it does, in the meantime, we still have all of those risks lurking in the background in the shadows, particularly commercial real estate that we all know is going to cause a tremendous amount of disruption sometime. And we just don't know how big of an adjustment will be, nor do we know what the fallout from that adjustment. You can't really predict it. I think that's one of the things that the Federal Reserve has struggled with going back and forth. They see the same risks from commercial real estate, yet they're just focused on consumer prices, which they really shouldn't be. So lots of ambiguity. And I think people would like to have a lot more clarity, but I'm not sure that's really what's in the cards here for the short run anyway. It still seems like even the data we got today on PMIs slowly grinding into that same shallow downturn.
Yeah. You know what? That's such a good point, because I feel like all of the recent conversations on the show, there are a lot of like divergent viewpoints too when it comes to the economy. And I'm hearing so many different, some people say, hey, we're getting a rate hike next. Some saying cuts. I don't even know. Obviously, I don't know. I'm not an expert, but I think ambiguity is a good way of putting it. You just said something that was really interesting to me in the, at the end of that answer, and that was the Fed being, you know, focused on consumer prices when they really shouldn't be. Can we explore that a little bit further?
Well, there's always that institutional bias. The Fed is always institutionally biased toward fearing and inflation. And this goes back not just Paul Volcker in the 1970s, this goes back to the very beginning. You look at the 1930s, for example, the Federal Reserve was afraid of inflation in the middle 1930s during the Great Depression. So they have this institutional bias to always be afraid of consumer prices, which somehow they let it go in the 1960s and 70s. So, you know, they're always afraid of inflation, yet maybe they don't know how to spot it, which is part of the problem. They don't really know where inflation comes from. So they look at consumer price data. They think, well, it has to do with a tight labor market, yet there's no correlation with the unemployment rate whatsoever. Especially in the last year and a half, the unemployment rate has gone lower and consumer price increases have come down at the same time. So the Phillips curve doesn't really matter there. They're afraid of expectations and things like that. But essentially, they have an institutional bias toward being an inflation fighter because they believe expectations matter more than anything else. And if they let go, they take their foot off the brake, so to speak. That's what they believe happens with rate hikes. Then people will start thinking, oh, the Fed's not an inflation fighter anymore. That will creep into my thought process. I'll start acting like the Fed isn't an inflation fighter. I'll start expecting inflation, and suddenly inflation will come. So that's where they're really at. And unless and until consumer price numbers get back down to their target, like they say, we have to be completely, utterly confident in the being able to stay at the target. They're going to continue to talk as if that's the biggest thing. Now, I think what the Fed is actually doing right here is trying to get the marketplace to do their work for them, which is really what the Federal Reserve is all about anyway. It's not about their interest rate policies. It's certainly not about money printing. The Fed doesn't do anything in the monetary system. It's essentially getting the marketplace to do the work for them. And that means because they believe higher interest rates are tightening, if you're less confident about consumer price pressures, then wouldn't it be great if the market started raising rates for you? So that's where this sudden talk about, oh, maybe we're not talking about rate hikes or rate cuts is coming from. They're trying to talk bond yields back up to maybe put the last stamp on getting rid of the consumer price pressure for good. So where interest rates were falling, I think this is the more interesting part, where interest rates were falling in the big rally late last year. In December, it appeared as if the Fed was ready to embrace lower rates, which means what were they seeing that they were okay with rates going lower? And now they're like, okay, wait a minute, we're premature here. So what they're really doing is trying to get the market to go to do the work for them, at least what they think is their work, which is higher interest rates. I don't think they'll actually hike rates this year. I think that's just they leave that threat out there to try to talk yields to go back higher. And that's really ultimately what they're trying to do, is that last little bit of consumer price pressures.
Interesting. So when you look at the markets today, what do you think the markets are pricing in or signaling?
I don't think it's changed all that much, because historically speaking, after you have a large rally in bonds, they take a couple months off. And that's how most markets work. It's never in a straight line. And usually after you have a big, and it was a really big move late last year, it was a historic size rally. I mean, it went to, we've only seen that happen in that same condensed fashion that far six times before in the last 30 years. There was a really big move in the bond market. And after that happens, you usually see a multi-month period where rates go flat to higher. That's really what they've been doing. They followed the historical pattern. It looked like at the end of January, as if the market might break that pattern with yields going lower, but then they came back out of it after, you know, everything kind of settled down there. So I think rates are doing the same thing that they've been doing for the last 5 months. The market's still looking at everything the same way, even if rates are going back higher than they were at the low point in December. Nothing really much has changed there. And of course, now the Fed is trying to ride that wave and say, okay, rates going higher in the marketplaces, we need a little bit more assurance that consumer price pressures are done. And the marketplace is saying, yeah, but we're more worried about all that other stuff that had your attention back in December when you were ready to embrace the bond rally.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we also talk about the Fed and like they shouldn't be focused so much on the consumer prices, yet they are, what from your perspective should they be focused on?
Well, inflation, real inflation, is a monetary phenomenon. They actually believe that too. They just have no idea what the monetary system is or how to monitor it. So from their perspective, they have to look at everything backwards. They start at the end of the process and say, okay, what are consumer prices doing now? And trying to figure out how we got there, and then try to look ahead from that and try to, how do we stop consumer prices if they start moving in a way we don't want them to? A traditional central bank that was an activist central bank would simply take some money out of the money supply, because that's what inflation is, the monetary issue. But we haven't had genuine inflation over the last couple of years. I know people hate it when I say that, but it's absolutely true. Even the Fed agrees with it. Jay Powell said so not long ago. There's actually what caused consumer prices to go so high and to stay there for what seems like a prolonged period of time was nothing more than a supply-demand imbalance, a supply shock. We had demand after the pandemic, which came back much faster than supply was able to supply. So essentially, the only way in economics for those two very different set of circumstances to reconcile is for prices to increase. And they did. They did so in a way that we've seen through supply shocks in all, you know, in economic history. Everything was consistent with that. As was the even though those price pressures were transitory, it takes a long time once you suffer a supply shock for price increases to begin to normalize. And prices are never going to go back to where they were. We shouldn't expect to go back to pre-2020 kind of pricing regime. That's not going to happen. What will happen is, and what is happening, is that as the supply shock begins to normalize, consumer price increases and the rate of increase goes back to normal. We see that repeatedly. But what the Federal Reserve has done has said that because we've had this prolonged supply shock, they then bring in their theories on the Phillips curve and expectations. And they're saying, well, if this supply shock lingers too long, then it has this risk of getting infected in people's expectations. And if it gets infected in people's expectations, they call it expectations becoming unanchored, then we have a real problem, at least according to their view. So they're not content to just sit back and say the supply shock will take care of itself. We really don't need to do anything, because the supply shock on the one hand will get better. There'll be fewer bottlenecks. There'll be better logistical flows and things like that. And on the other hand, high prices take care of demand. The cure for high prices is always high prices. So demand will come down because people can't afford to pay those high prices. And eventually things will normalize in a way that we've seen in the past. But the Fed has overlaid this expectations theory, and that's why they've taken these aggressive actions, and add that to their institutional bias. And that's why they're continuing to act as if their consumer price pressures are still a tremendous risk. They can't just sit back and say, you know, this is transitory. We were right all along. It was transitory. It takes 3 years for that to really play itself out.
Yeah. Yeah. Why can't they? Why can't they just let it play itself out? Why?
Well, the first part is the institutional bias, as well as this expectations theory. But the other thing is, and we all know, the Fed isn't actually independent. I mean, Jay Powell had to visit with President Biden, 2022? And you know there's been political pressure all along. And we're seeing this in Japan right now, where consumers... they notice consumer price increases, and they could not care less whether it's genuine inflation or a supply shock. People don't care. And why would they care? All they see is that their cost of living has gone way up, and they want somebody to do something about it. And so what do you do about it? Well, there's really nothing you can do except, you know, do whatever you can to help the supply situation better normalize. But you have this central bank that has advertised itself for decades as an inflation fighter. So quite naturally, people look at the Fed and say, why aren't you doing something about this? And the Fed naturally said, not really our job. This isn't our area of expertise. You know, this is not what we do. We don't have anything to do with getting oil out of the ground or moving containers around the rest of the world. That's not our problem. But, you know, the world that we live in, it's especially politics, it's about appearing to do something, not actually doing something. It's about appearing to do something. And so the Fed raised rates and did so aggressively and got on TV and said, we see this consumer price problem and we're doing something about it. So there was no way they could sit back and say transitory, because first of all, they would threaten their own expectations theory, but also the political pressure. They had to act and they had to make it into this big thing, because they had to make this big show out of doing something for the problem that was really getting people worked up, especially in 2022, which was an election year. And it's still a problem in places around, again, like I mentioned, Japan. Japan is The Japanese central bank is threatening to raise rates for the first time in, what, 16 years? And there's no economic justification for it. Japan's already in recession. It doesn't look like it's going to get any better here. And consumer prices, like in the United States, are already coming down very slowly. Yet the Japanese government is as unpopular as ever. So the Bank of Japan is being forced into a rate hike that there's no economic justification for. And they're doing so because they need to appear, for the government's sake, to be doing something about the thing that is really, really making Japanese people angry.
Hey there. I hope that you are enjoying listening to this episode. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you could leave us a rating and a review, it would help us so much in continuing to grow the show and bringing some incredible guests for these longer form discussions. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. Oh, wow. It's so great having you on, because I feel like we're all just like learning a lot from you, and I always learn from you. I want to go back to the economic picture, a lot of the ambiguity there, and you're talking about the downswing in the business cycle, this like slowly progressing, painfully slowly progressing. And when you look under the hood, Jeff, of a lot of this data, I imagine the picture doesn't look so great, and it's not the resilient economy narrative that you see out there. Can you walk us through like some of the things that maybe are a bit more, I don't know how you want to put it, but they're a bit more like warning signals, if maybe, when it comes to the economy.
Yeah, real economy itself, we start with the labor market in the United States, because that's the one thing that really sticks out as the, you know, the statistics and the idea where the economy has not just remained resilient, but actually appears to be exhibiting a substantial amount of strength, right? Especially the last 2 months of payrolls, where you've had this sudden acceleration into December and now January. You think, okay, what's going on here? But you look beyond the headline payroll number, and up until December, we had already seen a divergence between the establishment survey, which is what everybody looks at, that's the payroll figure, and the household survey, which is a different survey of the employment situation, where they actually ask people. The establishment survey, as the name implies, they survey employers and say, how many people are you employing? Or the household survey is they survey household and say, how many people in your household are actually employed? And those two had diverged, you know, for quite a period of time before the end of last year. But what that said was that there's a different view of the employment market from the perspective of households. And that had gone back several months before, and especially full-time employment. The number of Americans who said they were employed full-time has plummeted, which is not the kind of thing that you would expect to find in a robust economy that's really resilient and strong. You would expect the opposite. So what that said already was that employers were seeing the business environment turn in the wrong direction, a downswing, and they were taking proactive steps to manage their costs. Because what do you want to do? You don't want to fire workers. Nobody ever wants to fire workers and do layoffs. You want to hang in there as long as you can, hoping the economy turns around. But you might have some revenue pressure, therefore cost pressure. So the easiest thing to do is maybe convert some of your employees from full-time to part-time, cut back a couple hours, things like that. So what it suggested was that employers in the U.S. were taking proactive steps because they were feeling a downturn, even if they weren't laying off workers like we expect in a recession period. But then toward the end of last year, it wasn't just the establishment survey versus the household survey. It was the establishment survey versus the establishment survey, because the establishment survey doesn't just measure the number of people who are employed in the economy. It also asks about hours and wages and pay and things like that. And so over the last several months of 2023, and then, of course, January 2024, huge divergence, the hours worked index from the establishment survey has gone like this. So the payroll headline goes like this, and the hours goes like this. And those two really don't reconcile each other. They don't reconcile with each other. So you wonder what's going on there. I think it comes back to what we were saying before. There's so much ambiguity in the nature of this business cycle. It's become very difficult for these statistics to capture the full extent of both sides of the equation. And so you have some of the numbers that look like recession and others that look like not recession. But over time, if you step back and look at it, not just the employment statistic, but others, more are moving in the direction of the recession than are moving in the direction of the strong economy. And we see that most clearly in the goods economy with the inventory cycle. So you see a lot of manufacturers saying, you know, look, Retail sales are weak. Nominal sales have been slowing down for quite some time. Businesses that thought they had to stock up inventories because the supply shock was going to be around forever and it was going to be tough to get things. Well, they're going back to just-in-time inventories. So inventories are starting to shrink back down. Plus, you have the cyclical pressures where spending isn't as robust as it was, especially in nominal terms. So there's an inventory cycle behind all of that too. And you also have the global economy, because we are in a globally synchronized system. It's just not as tightly synchronized as you might expect, where the rest of the world is looking at the U.S. and saying, hey, we're really struggling out here. Have you seen what the economy is like outside the U.S.? And those pressures do make a difference to the domestic economy, too. They do spill over eventually over time. We do have weakness outside the United States comes into the U.S. There is no such thing as decoupling. So it's really a matter of, with all the ambiguity in certain statistics, there is some clarity in certain parts when you look at how much is moving in one direction versus another. It's not like the balance is shifting toward the strong economy. The balance is continually shifting toward the weak economy. It's just not doing it all at once like we have in our minds when we picture a recession. I think that's a big part of the issue here too, is that most people think a recession is the economy's just fine one day, and then the next day there's millions of people on the unemployment line. That's really never how a business cycle has been. There's usually a prolonged progression between clear expansion and clear contraction. In fact, you can be in a recession for many, many months and not really see any layoffs. That has been a typical throughout economic history. But this cycle has been even more weird and odd because it has been that process shifting between expansion and recession has been extended so much longer that it's causing all of this ambiguity to begin with. So when you look around the data, like I said, it's the shift between more moving in the direction of downturn and less moving in the direction of the strong economy. It leaves like U.S. GDP and the payroll report is almost outliers at this point.
Outliers, yeah. It also makes you wonder, Jeff, like how much did the fiscal side of things prop up the economy or GDP in the last year or two versus like what the real economy would be doing if you didn't have that?
That's a really good question. I don't know if it's really hard to quantify, but you do get that sense, right? I mean, just looking at it from a raw numbers perspective, the U.S. federal government ran just an absolutely insane deficit last year. They issued $3.4 trillion in new money debt in an economy that didn't grow anywhere near $3.4 trillion. So you're thinking, what happened if the federal government didn't spend all that additional cash? What would the economy actually have looked like in 2023? I don't think it would have been a disaster, but it sure as hell wouldn't have looked like what everybody pictures of it. So there had to have been some component or some contribution from the federal government going absolutely crazy last year that did, and in fact, help in some sense. A good example, just to digress a little bit here, I think is last January. You look at the income statistics and the spending statistics, they show this massive jump in January, which was related to pretty much explained by the huge cost of living increase adjustments in Social Security and some of the other government transfer programs. A huge contribution because government transfer programs are tied to consumer price, like CPI, and the CPI was absolutely huge in 2022. So you had this huge increase in transfer payments at the margins to begin last year. So just that alone, we were on a downswing at the end of 2022 into 2023. And then suddenly you had this boost and everybody thought, oh, we were talking about recession to end 2022. And then all of a sudden by the middle of 2023, it's like this economy's really robust. How much of that was due to the increase in transfer payments from the federal government? It seems like there's probably some relationship there, just a direct impact, as well as any second and third order effects that might come out of it. So that's a tough one to really pin down as far as getting some solid numbers, but we have to believe there was some part of that. And so looking ahead to where you're thinking for 2024, if the government isn't going to be doing as much in 2024 as it was in 2023, does that then mean the U.S. has less fiscal support this year, that maybe it starts to look more like recession and shallow downturn, or maybe even worse than shallow downturn? That's a possibility. It's probably a good possibility, starting with the fact that we didn't have the massive cost of living adjustment increase in transfer payments to begin this year like we did last year. So even that part is already different. And maybe that had a big role in the way and why retail sales in the United States in January were so contracted so much and were so disappointing. It's, you know, I wish I had a better solid answer, but you have to believe that there is some role there, some substantial contribution.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to like pin you down per se, but and you don't have to even answer if you don't want to. But so the probability of a recession, is that increasing for you? That seems more likely. Like, do you have a probability there?
I don't think the probabilities have changed at all. The matter is always timing. It's not about probability. I mean, I think the probability has been high really since the fall of 2022. The problem is timing. When does that actually show up? When does it actually happen? That's what, you know, my operating thesis is, that we're in the downswing of a business cycle. Therefore, the end of that downswing is going to be something that looks like a recession. How bad it gets and what that ultimately means, we don't know yet. Depends on all these other factors, you know, these lurking risks back in the shadow and how they actually play out. But I think the probability of a contraction remains as high as it has been all along. And as I said, more and more data moves in that direction than moves away from that direction, which means, in my view, we're still on the same path to recession. It's just that path has been so prolonged and extended and elongated. It's easy for people to say, well, if it was going to happen, then it would have by now. And I think that's a mistake, that, you know, a cycle is a cycle. And as long as we're still in the same process of the cycle, the end point will be the same regardless, even if we can't pin down exactly when that is. And it may have been that fiscal support last year was one big reason why the cycle has been extended as far as it has. I think another one is disinflation itself. The fact that especially gasoline and energy prices came down at the end of 2022 to start 2023 kind of kickstarted a rebound of sorts. We saw that in many economies around the world where they had a little bit of a downturn and then a rebound. It wasn't all that much, say, in Europe or in other places like Asia. But in the U.S., it seemed to have a more prominent effect. And that extended the cycle a little bit further. It wasn't enough to kickstart a recovery, but it was enough to just create a little bit of a balance and a little bit of positivity in the middle part of last year. And then those two things combined toward the end of the year, GDP looked good, but we're, you know, I keep coming back to, we're still in the cyclical, we still see all of the cyclical indications, which suggest that however long it takes to get there, the destination is still the same.
Yeah. Dave Rosenberg pointed out that some of those are non-recurring, you know, when it comes to the picture for the economy. And that's why he has not thrown in the towel on his recession call. Okay, you mentioned there are some lurking risks in the shadows. Can we bring those to the surface for this conversation? What are those lurking risks for you?
Well, the two most prominent are both real estate. One is commercial real estate in the United States, and the other is real estate properties in China. And there are direct risks from the Chinese bubble that could potentially spill over around the rest of the world. Not just the direct impact if the Chinese economy really does experience the, quote, hard landing. That will have a direct impact, obviously, downstream in all sorts of emerging market economies that depend upon China for economic growth. That will then have all sorts of spillover impacts in the United States and the Western world, too. Risk aversion, sentiment, that kind of thing, as well as exposure, direct exposure from Western banks to potentially counterparts on the Chinese side. So we have to watch the Chinese situation relatively closely, because that is a big, tremendous risk, not just for China. It is for the global economy. And of course, the other one we've been talking about commercial real estate really since it went into its really ridiculous bubble proportions in 2021 and 2022. I mean, we could all see that one coming. And so really the question with commercial real estate is, valuations are up here still. Prices are down here because not a lot of volume of sales are being booked. So we don't really know where prices are. And banks and everyone else are carrying values up here. And there's a huge disconnect there. So we already have to take this many losses. And the losses might be actually down here when we start getting more sales. So there's lots of losses to come from commercial real estate. And I just did a webinar recently where it put some numbers on how big the commercial real estate bubble is. And according to the Z1 statistics of the Federal Reserve, the amount of debt that went into multifamily mortgages as well as commercial mortgages, all the office towers and retail projects we keep hearing about, It was about $1 trillion in a 2-year period. We went from about $4.6 trillion in debt that the Federal Reserve was able to identify to about $5.6 trillion. That's a pretty substantial increase in just debt in a relatively short period of time. And that we know that it was based on bad assumptions. So again, there's going to be a sizable amount of losses. Who's going to end up taking them? And what happens when they are taken? Those are the two questions that we don't have any better idea today than we did a year ago. Because everybody has sort of just decided we're going to play possum and just play dead. Let's just do nothing and hope this thing just magically fixes itself. When we know that's not going to be the case. Eventually, something's going to happen. Borrowers and property owners are eventually going to start walking away from the properties as these refinancings come up and banks are going to balk at refinancing. Then what happens? Do the banks start repossessing properties? And if they do repossess properties, what do they do with them? Are they going to start selling them? If they start selling them, is that going to lead to distressed sales and fire sales? Those are all the questions that we would like to have answers today that we have absolutely no answers because everything is just kind of stuck. The massive adjustment that needs to take place in commercial real estate is entirely in front of us, which makes it one of those things that are, you know, it's really ominous because we know the numbers are huge. We know the bubble proportions were there. We know the valuations are insane. We just don't know how the process is going to play out because we can't answer and predict these types of what is going to happen when all of these things really start to move again. So that is a huge, tremendous risk. Though, I mean, the good news here, is that the proportions in commercial real estate, as big as they are nothing like the residential real estate bubble had been 15, 16, 17 years ago. So it's not the same scale. It is enough to be concerned about. And this commercial real estate is also not the same type of situation as the big bubble last time. So there is a possibility, and pretty maybe a good possibility, that this adjustment that needs to take place can take place without being catastrophic, without being more than maybe a minor nuisance. Banks take some loans. Maybe we have a couple of small banks that fail, but it doesn't lead to the type of crisis proportions that we all potentially fear. But on the same token, on the other side of that coin, there is the risk that could take place too, because again, we don't know how all these processes play out. And the risks are substantial because the numbers are substantial.
Mm-hmm. Well, given all of what we've discussed in this conversation, how are you thinking about like asset allocation, portfolio construction? I don't know how much detail you can share there, but how are you thinking about, you know, maybe navigating this environment?
Well, if you're concerned about the downside, which to me, that's something you should be concerned about. I mean, look, if you want to play in the stock market, that's perfectly fine. Just realize what you're getting into there. That's not a fundamental marketplace. It's a casino. Let's be honest. That's what it is. But yeah, making money. Everybody's making money in the stock market. So it's tough to say, hey, don't buy stocks because share prices are, talk about resilience. Share prices can be incredibly resilient, but just understand what you're getting into there. There's a massive amount of risk because stocks are essentially the beauty contest. And when if everybody believes that stocks are safe and that stocks are pricing a soft landing, and then suddenly everybody doesn't believe that, then you're the one left holding the bag. That's the risk in the stock market. If you're not willing to take on that risk, there's easy things that you can do. Thanks to the Federal Reserve, Treasury bills are yielding, you know, north of 5%. You could roll over Treasury bills for the next little while and get, you know, 4% or 5%. Even if rates go down, at first they're not going to go down all that quickly. So you could roll over Treasury bills and get a decent return out of that. If you're willing to take a little bit more risk, a little more Fed risk, Fed talking risk, you can go duration in the bond market. Because if you think that these risks are going to play out eventually, that means that demand for safety and liquidity is going to go up, which means bond prices are going to go up and interest rates are going to go down. That would mean that not only do you get a decent return on the coupon, you're also going to have a tailwind for price appreciation as bonds begin to more and more reflect the downside fundamentals that we're just talking about here, assuming you believe that's the case. So if you're willing to take a lot of risk, I mean, don't chase stocks. Who knows how far they can continue to run? Markets can remain irrational longer than you can stay solid. That's absolutely the case. But if you're not willing to take that risk, there's decent returns in safety. And I think not only is there decent returns in safety, just given the interest rates, there's also a strong possibility then you get a little bit of price appreciation too. And if things really do go the wrong way, you get a lot of price appreciation because demand for safety and liquidity go way up. So I think that's really the two kind of really easy investment strategies to follow, depending upon your perspective.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, I always enjoy having you on. I want to give you the final few minutes here to let folks know more about your work with Eurodollar University, how they can support your work, and any parting thoughts, anything that you want to leave the audience with to think about. The floor is yours.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, Eurodollar University, I have a YouTube channel where we talk about all these things, especially get into the monetary system, the curve signals, all that kind of stuff that we touched on here. Macroeconomic, but really monetary focus, monetary perspective. And I also have a website, eurodollar.university, research subscriptions, as well as background material, memberships in Eurodollar University. We talk about what the Eurodollar system actually is, how it's supposed to work. What does the Fed really do? What does the Fed not do? That kind of thing. How do you interpret curves and monetary signals and spreads and all of those key indications that you need to watch in order to have a sense of what's really happening around not just the United States economy, but also the financial system, risks, the rest of the global economy and the global system as well. That's Eurodollar University. I think as far as parting thoughts, this is one of those periods where, because we've talked about, Julia, ambiguity is so high. And you're hearing different viewpoints. As you were saying earlier, just in your guess, which is completely understandable, it's really difficult to try to anchor your analysis and perception on one single thing. So my recommendation is that you don't do that. You don't watch one thing. Watch as many things as you possibly can. And I know it's difficult to do. I mean, most people don't have the time to spend focused on, you know, economic data and financial markets and every minute move. But find a broad cross-section of information, whether it be, you know, market information or economic data, and see where the balance is shifting. If everything is going, if it's moving in one direction, it doesn't have to be everything, but if you can get a clear sense that things are moving in one direction or another across a broad survey of information, I think that's the best thing to do right now, because it is one of the most confusing and ambiguous periods maybe we've ever seen.
Well, Jeff Snyder, host of the Eurodollar University podcast, it's been an absolute pleasure having you back on the show. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and all of your knowledge. I really appreciate you taking the time, Jeff.
All right. Thank you, Julia.